Ken Forrester, Executive Director at Momenta. Welcome to our Digital Thread podcast, produced by, for, and about digital industry leaders. In this series of conversations, we capture insights from the best and brightest minds in digital industry. They're executives, entrepreneurs, advisors, and other thought leaders. What they have in common is, like our team at Momenta, they are deep industry operators. We hope you find these podcasts informative, and as always, we welcome your comments and suggestions. Good day and welcome to episode 204 of Momenta Digital Thread podcast series. Today, I'm greatly pleased to host Professor Bill Allett, Managing Director, Martin Trust Center for MIT Entrepreneurship and Ethernet Investors Professor of the Practice, MIT Sloan School of Management. Professor Allett is changing the way entrepreneurship is understood, taught, and practiced around the world. He's an award-winning educator and author whose current work is built off the foundation of his 25-year successful business career, first at IBM and then as a three-time serial entrepreneur. During this time, he directly raised over $100 million and, more importantly, created hundreds of millions of dollars of shareholder value through his companies. Since 2009, he has been responsible for leading the development of entrepreneur education across MIT at the Trust Center, where he became professor of the practice at MIT Sloan in 2017. His first book, Disciplined Entrepreneurship, released in August 2013, has been translated into over 20 languages and has been the content for three online EDX courses, which have been taken by hundreds of thousands of people in 199 different countries. The accompanying follow-on book, Disciplined Entrepreneur Workbook, was released in April 2017. The material from these two books is used to teach entrepreneurship in hundreds of universities worldwide. He is widely known and published in places such as Wall Street Journal, TechCrunch, the Boston Globe, the Sloan Management Review, the Kauffman Foundation, Entrepreneur Magazine, MIT Sloan Experts, and more. He has also been a featured speaker on shows such as CNBC's Squawk Box, BBC News, Bloomberg News, as well as event and conferences around the world. He has degrees from Harvard and MIT and has served on various boards of U.S. public tech companies. Bill, welcome to our Digital Thread podcast.
Ken, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. And a call out to Jane from our team who attended one of your entrepreneur sessions not too long ago. So she highly recommended you after that session. So what would you consider to be your digital thread? In other words, the one or more thematic threads that define your digital industry journey?
Yeah, it's funny. I thought about it. And the whole thing, I think, boils down to the spirit of a pirate and the execution skills of a Navy SEAL. I've always thought that, you know, from my background and where I come from, I didn't always just want to go along, get along, do the same thing. I felt an urge to do something different. And that's kind of the entrepreneurial spirit, gene. I shouldn't say gene, spirit. But once you do that, anybody can do that. That's not hard. But the hard part is the spirit of a pirate and the execution skills of a Navy SEAL. Once you decide to do something different, you have to do it with great discipline. And that kind of is the digital thread throughout my whole kind of career.
I was impressed that your origin story is grounded in direct operational roles at IBM and then three of your startups. What was it that you learned at IBM that led you to starting your own startups?
Well, first of all, when I joined IBM in 1981, there was no such thing as kind of an entrepreneurial career path. I remember my mother, God rest her soul, she just thought I was unemployed when I became an entrepreneur. Back when the 1980s, it was just, you know, you worked in big companies, you worked in the government, you became a lawyer, a doctor, you know, whatever it was. But entrepreneurship wasn't a career path. So I didn't really think about it. I just graduated from college, played a basketball in Europe for a year, and I needed to get a job. And the most likely, you know, best place to work turned out to be IBM, and they trained me in technology. And I had been an engineer, and I thought, this is great. I'll learn technology and the computers. And I saw that as the future. But actually, what I learned at IBM was much more than that. The technology was kind of the table stakes. What I really learned was how to take a technology and convert that into value for customers, and how to build a team and kind of work with really great people. Once you get that, you don't want anything else. Back in the 1980s, IBM got the best people. It was really them and General Electric, which is kind of ironic now, which shows you how fast things are moving. And once they hired, they never hired from outside. They hired right out of college. And we had this enormously talented cohort of people who came in all together. And they taught us a real world MBA, you know what the technology is you needed to understand, of course. But even more so, how do you solve customer problems and then get customers to adopt that and then pay for that in a way that's sustainable? Even more so, we'll talk about this later, how to manage people and teams, because everything comes down to people. Can you build a great high-performing team? And at IBM, they were very transparent and direct about giving you performance feedback and appraisals, and then you had to give them to other people as well. And ultimately, end of the day, I went to IBM to learn technology. Then I learned business. But the big thing that I learned was how to work and build great high-performing teams. And that's really something that I think people underestimate if they go directly into entrepreneurship.
What a great foundation. As you draw the analogy to GE, we've often heard the same during especially the Jack Welch era of the GE way, if you will. So let's talk a little briefly about your startup experience, co-founding Cambridge Decision Dynamics, Sensible, which was sold to 3D Systems, and co-leading Visage as CFO. If you had to summarize that time into three learnings relative to entrepreneurship, what would they be?
You have to, first of all, have a coherent, cohesive team to launch something. Ideas are the booby prize. And all these things, you know, whether the technology was great, the idea was great, that's not what made you successful. In my first company, I learned you've got to have a great team. And if you don't have a great team, nothing else matters. In the second one, we had a good team and a great technology. And then I learned that, you know, you really have to build the business from the customer back. And then once you do that, you have to really build a scalable business. It's not just enough to get on and go from 0 to 15 miles per hour. You then have to take it from 15 to 40 miles per hour, 60 miles per hour, whatever it is that you're going to do to scale it. And then the last one was at Visage was really entrepreneurship is everybody likes to make it more complicated than it really is and say, you know, it's some sort of magical thing. And by the third one, I learned that I didn't work as hard on the last one as I did on the first one. And yet we went from 50 million to half a billion. Last one, half a billion used to be a huge deal in market cap in 2.5 years. And I worked less hard. It was a matter of working smart rather than just working hard. Of course, we worked hard, but that wasn't the determining factor. And I realized actually entrepreneurship can be taught, and there's a methodology to this. Even though in the first one, we had these very complicated system dynamics technology. The second one was a force feedback technology, robotics technology. The last one was a biometrics technology. But the patterns were the same. The first principles were the same. So that at the end of the day, from the third one, I looked at it and felt very confident. You know, you can approach any problem and there's principles and frameworks that you can use to solve it. It's generalizable across these different markets and technologies and problems. Those are the key takeaways I took away from it. If you had to summarize it in three bites, three line items from those experiences.
And actually, it's interesting the way you present those. I have to imagine as you kind of presented those align with your really three startup experiences, coherent team, customer back, and work smarter. I think the work smarter certainly was because you had done it before. You had the patterns in mind. And as you said, there is a discipline that can be applied toward entrepreneurship. And so in some sense, that's a great lead into what you're doing now. So let's fast forward now to your role at MIT. So you're leading the development of entrepreneurship education across MIT at the Trust Center. Can you tell us a bit about this program and your remit in this role?
Yes. And it is a direct line, ironically here, not that I plotted it beforehand. The first experience not being very successful, second experience being more successful, as I joke about being infinitely successful, because in math, anything over zero is infinity. But the third one being even more, that entrepreneurship could be taught. And that was the big kind of breakthrough for me. And when I went back and, you know, they used to have me give guest talks at MIT, I was like, you know, I told them, well, you really didn't teach me entrepreneurship like you should have, because it can be taught. And their point was, they kept asking questions. And they said, that's great. And I said, well, why is that great? You didn't teach it to me. And they said, because you're going to teach it now. And I said, no, that's not the point. And they said, yeah, you got to teach it. You understand it better than, you explained it better than what we've heard before. And so the old story, no good deed goes unpunished. What I do now is there's two fundamental premises we start with. A, anyone can be an entrepreneur. And that's a premise that I didn't believe at first, but it's absolutely clear that it's true if you think about it very long. You can go around the world or just look at history. People back in the Babylonian times or Roman or Greek times, whatever, is they didn't lay dying on the streets saying, I've got to get onto LinkedIn to post my resume to get a job at a big corporation. From the beginning of time, people made things, they traded things, they provided services to other people to survive. And you see this today when you go around the world. I was in North Vietnam, people don't sit around and say, hey, I got to go get a job at Google. They create their own jobs. So human beings are innately entrepreneurial. It's only been since the Industrial Revolution that our society, our education has kind of like pulled this out of them. And so anyone can be an entrepreneur. The second point is entrepreneurship can be taught. Just as you said, if you think about it, it's kind of obvious. The more times you do something like this, entrepreneurship, the better you get it. It's not math. It's not a science. It's a craft. And the more reps you get in, the better you get at it. And so what we do at MIT now is we inspire people that, yes, you can be an entrepreneur, which is, is not something that people, are told that often. But once they realize you can be an entrepreneur, and we give examples, they see them with their own eyes of their colleagues, then we say, now we'll teach you how to be a better entrepreneur by teaching you those first principles, by giving you those reps in a safe space, and then by giving you feedback about what you can do better. And so that's what we do at MIT now. We integrate kind of this inspiring them with the mindset, that's the heart, and then we give them the head, the knowledge of here's what you do. Once you know you can be an entrepreneur and you want to be an entrepreneur, then we give you the first principles of how to do that, the head. We go from the heart to the head. And then we go to the hands is next, because you can't just know what to do. You have to do it. Entrepreneurship is not a theoretical exercise. It's a craft that you have to do. So we integrate the theory with the practice in an apprenticeship model. The fourth thing is a little more subtle that we teach is the home. And that is a different way of operating. We were taught with command, control, and conquer. That's what I was taught at IBM. You need to own all the resources. You need to tell them what to do. You need to completely de-risk it. And that's not how entrepreneurs operate. Entrepreneurship was once defined by Howard Stevenson of Harvard as the pursuit of opportunities with resources beyond your control. So this idea of having to control everything, in today's world, you have to learn how to operate in a distributed model. If I need some help on something, Ken, and you're in Switzerland, I'll call you up and ask you if you can help me, and you will help me if you know that I will help you in something else. So it's a much more efficient distributed model of kind of, if you think of bartering your expertise, your services, it's a community-based model. So what we do is we teach people, again, the heart, the spirit, the mindset to be an entrepreneur, the head, the knowledge, the first principles, the frameworks to be a successful entrepreneur, the hand, we give them the opportunity through outside of the classroom, co-curricular stuff to apply this and learn how to take theory into practice. And then the home, the community is how do you operate in this way that's not naturally taught by business schools and corporations since the Industrial Revolution, a distributed community-based way of operating. Those are the four pillars on which our program is built. And then we have programs in the classroom, outside the classroom, in companies. And that's the whole genesis and pillars of what we do.
Mm-hmm. I want to jump into your book in a moment, but let me jump forward real quick. I'll play a little bit of the devil's advocate here. So, Silicon Valley startup lore has built this narrative that says the most successful entrepreneurs leave school to pursue their startups. Take Bill Gates, Michael Dell, the co-founders of Twitter and WhatsApp, just to name a few. Peter Thiel, who we all love, the Icon Class VC, even gave entrepreneurs $100,000 to abandon college and pursue their dreams. So in a sense, you may be the contrarian here, offering entrepreneurship as a university course. Can entrepreneurship really be taught, or does it need to be learned in action, i.e., as you said, the real world MBA earlier?
Yeah, look, Ken, I'm an engineer, and I'm not a theatrical person who's out there trying to make money off this. All that narrative, there is a word, and I don't know if I can use it on this, but it's bullshit. The evidence is very clear. The evidence is very clear. Do you know what the average age of a successful entrepreneur is? It's not 19. It's not 18. It's 38. It's probably closer to 40 right now. There are these movies and there's this, you know, lore of, oh, Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, all that stuff. Those people are the outliers. And I could go through step by step here, but let me just give you a few numbers. Is entrepreneurship is not an individual sport. It's a team sport. Data is super clear. The more founders you have, the more likely you are to be successful. Just think about it for a second. Does an individual get that much done in the world? They don't. You have to build teams. And we have data in ours right now. This narrative that, you know, this alpha dog male needs to be the leader of it is just not the case. Right now in our cohorts, females are more successful than, and this doesn't mean every female, it's just a bit of, but females are more successful than males. And they don't buy into this, you know, Steve Jobs, the whole thing with Steve Jobs, they rewrite it. Now, if I'm a venture capitalist, I probably want to find that individual who's very good at technology and then be the business person around it. But you need the business person as well. And so I don't buy into it. The data is very clear and we could go on about it. Entrepreneurship can be taught. We take people all the time who have not been entrepreneurs, that there's some magical gene that makes you an entrepreneur. It's just complete rubbish. I defy these people to show me data, rigorous data, evidence that these things are true. It's a narrative that's made in the movies and it's not true in real life.
And I appreciate your directness because coming from the left coast myself, that narrative seems to be woven into the Valley's ecosystem in some sense. And I think you're right. This is entrepreneurship for the mainstream, right? Not for the outliers.
Ken, let me just go back. And you said, you know, Peter Thiel. You know, I just think that the narrative that Peter Thiel, people, you know, look, all of us are right in some situations and wrong in other situations. And to take anyone and say everything that they say is correct is not a helpful work. We should have debate things. This idea that Peter Thiel pays people $100,000 to drop out of school, I find offensive. I find it offensive, to be quite honest. Is that what he would do? No, it's not. It's other people's lives that he's doing that. And for my kids, if you look at the standard entrepreneur, they should go to college. They should finish college. Are you going to start a biotech company if you drop out because you can write some code? The answer is no. And the world is getting more complex. If we're going to solve climate change, we need people with a solid background in STEM. We need well-adjusted people who know how to manage. I'll go back to what made me successful as an entrepreneur. It wasn't some innate gene I had. It was not. It was the fact of what I learned at IBM as to how to manage people and how to effectively build teams. And then if someone's not performing well, to work with them to make them a poor performer. And if they can't get there, than to help them find another opportunity. And that's not stuff you've learned if you drop out of school. You know, it's just, I find that an unhelpful model. Sure, you can pay someone $100,000 to drop out of school as an investment thesis. Absolutely. If I have a lot of money and I just sit here and pay $100,000 for people to drop out of school, and I find one Mark Zuckerberg from a portfolio management, that's fabulous. But you know what? What happens to all the other 99.99% of the people who didn't get that and they dropped out of college? Are they going to go back to college? I'll tell you, Ken, they don't. Because college is not just about what you learn in the classroom. It's about the people that you walked into school with freshman year and you graduate with, and they're your lifelong friends. And I can tell you that as someone who's now over 60. My best friends are from those days. And those things have been invaluable to me over and over. Life isn't about one transaction. And we shouldn't treat young people as a portfolio of opportunities to optimize off. Excuse me for that, Ken, but I couldn't let it go.
No, actually, I really appreciate you hitting that directly on, because I think, you know, some of our listeners, again, you know, probably those around Silicon Valley will naturally be thinking of that. And the fact that you're teaching entrepreneurship at an Ivy League school well-known technical university is quite a testament to how far this thinking has come along that it can be taught. So, you know, going back to your principles, anyone could be an entrepreneur and it can be taught.
MIT is not an Ivy League school. MIT is a land-grant institute that was formed. And there is no legacy. It's not an Ivy League school. It's not about prestige. It's about getting the job done. It's about bringing facts. And I think it's important. That's just an important distinction. We're not the 1% reinforcing it. We're a land-grant university that was built like an ag and tech school. And that's what we are. And I think that's important that we bring that to MIT has brought that into society at a level. But I think it's important to understand MIT is not an Ivy League school. It is a land-grant university that was set up for immigrants and immigrants' kids to man the Industrial Revolution. And that's a fundamentally different DNA from the get-go. And just to be clear, I'm not against, you know, Ivy League schools. My undergraduate degree is from an arts and crafts school called Harvard, and I'm all for it. And I think I learned valuable lessons there. But I think there's this, everything in life is a balance.
Yeah. Well, as you said, this is really about entrepreneurship for the mainstream.
Yeah.
As you've just discussed, MIT, it sounds like a school very much that has been in the mainstream of America. So let's drill down into your book, Disciplined Entrepreneurship, which you wrote in August 2013, and of course, the accompanying Disciplined Entrepreneur Workbook in 2017. What is disciplined entrepreneurship?
The whole book is just mind-blowing to me because disciplined entrepreneurship is basically the premise that I just said to you is that anyone can be an entrepreneur and it can be taught, but it requires the spirit of a pirate and the execution skills of a Navy SEAL. And we need, but if we're going to teach it to people to have the execution skills of a Navy SEAL, we need to teach it in a systematic way that doesn't presume that there's just one singular answer to it. And so disciplined entrepreneurship is just mind-blowing to me, was put together as a reader for my course at MIT, where I said, you know, what helped me make me successful? And I pulled from all the different things that made me successful, not things that I created myself. I didn't come up with something new. I just said, when you look at what worked, there's this company called Procter & Gamble, which has been incredibly successful and is often overlooked in the history of entrepreneurship in Silicon Valley. Everybody talks about Fairchild Semiconductor. But when you look at a lot of the people that really drove that, the success of Silicon Valley, Procter & Gamble comes up. And what was it there? It was their focus on how do you determine who the customer is, the demographic, psychographic, and build your product and your pricing and your messaging and everything back from that. And if you can do that for toilet paper, if you can do that for toothpaste, then when a technology product comes along, those same principles are very useful to you. And that's what I learned. And then there was also things like Geoffrey Moore's classic, I'm sure you remember, Ken, Crossing the Chasm. And how did that affect? And that was another tool in the toolbox. And then what about Blue Ocean Strategy? And then what about some stuff like, you know, some of the stuff Lean Startup and then Steve Blank's doing, and then stuff Stefan Tomke's doing. And then I just had time when I finally sat down and said, what worked in the third time that I didn't know the first one? And then what would I go back and tell other people? And that's what I built into this, my class. And it was really a toolbox of all the different things. But then once you have the toolbox, you have to have kind of instructions as to how to use the toolbox. And so disciplined entrepreneurship said, what were all the tools that I used? And I've looked at other people and what worked for them. And this, again, evidence-based, not kind of a narrative, but what's worked, what can we see that's worked, and then put the different tools in the toolbox and then said, here's how you should use them. Here's the general sequence in which you should use them. And that's what disciplined entrepreneurship is. It's, think of it as an open source toolbox that you just pick the different tools out there, put them in there, and then say, here's how you use them in a systematic 24-step kind of approach. And it worked for us. We tried lots of different things at MIT. And then it was the reader for our class. And then Wiley asked if they could publish it. And I never suspected in my wildest dreams that it would be in 27 different languages and be used around the world. But that's what entrepreneurship needs. It needs a common language as opposed to what's the singular, shiny new thing that comes along. And that's what this was. It was a open source kind of, I'm not trying to invent something new. What's worked? Let's just take what's out there And let's put those tools on one side and then say, here's how you should approach it on the other side. Because it's not just, you know, what are the tools? You have to say, you first have to start with the customer and work your way back. And then you have to figure out, how do you create value for them? Then you have to figure out, how do you extract value? And understanding how you extract value, you have to understand the acquisition process. And then you build it. Entrepreneurship is fraught with the shiny new thing. What's the new thing? And there's good stuff in Lean Startup, but there was this thing about just build the product. And that's not right. I mean, we know that's not right. But sometimes when new technology comes along, it makes it easier to build the product so you can run experiments faster. Well, we know that. So this was just taking what was out there and saying, here's how to make sense of it. Sorry for the long answer, Ken.
No, not at all. It was good. And it hit some other points I was thinking about asking along the way as well. You know, when you think of Lean Startup and a number of the books around it, it assumes some kind of digital product at the end, right? Which certainly has different development cycles than a physical product might be or services might be. I'm curious, are there particular sectors, geographies, or founder profiles that you found have been more successful with your discipline entrepreneurship program?
You know, I thought it would be IT products because I don't understand the biotech industry and the physical products as well. Well, no, actually, I shouldn't say that. I understand physical IT products very well, but I didn't think the biotech. The first principles they apply very well across biotech, IT, software, hardware, climate tech. Each one of them needs to be customized, but pretty much, you know, there's more emphasis on other ones. Like when you have a hardware product, it's even more important that you don't just go out there and build a product. But it's just the coefficients on how much you emphasize different things change. But the first principles are pretty much the same.
Now, as we're recording this, it's literally the Monday after the fallout of the Silicon Valley Bank crash. And thank God the Fed has decided to step in and make sure everybody's whole. But it certainly came close over the weekend for Momenta and a lot of our portfolio companies, as well as I understand your sons who are entrepreneurs. What can we learn from this crash?
Well, I think this in one of our classes, we say, as an entrepreneur, what's the most important characteristic of an entrepreneur? And the most important characteristics of an entrepreneur, again, I want to make sure that I don't fall in the trap of what other people say. Entrepreneurs only exist in venture-backed startups. They do not, and we as a society cannot have that. It's a very pure form of entrepreneurs and startups. But we need entrepreneurships and large entrepreneurs and large corporations and academics and government. Otherwise, we as a society are not going to be able to be successful. You know, we have this class, and you know, after we've kind of gone through it, and we say, we call it the oh shit class, like, what is going to go wrong? What's going to go wrong in your startup? And we go through this list and people say, oh, we'll run out of money with this and that. And then I go through it and I say, no, the number one thing that will go wrong in your startup is everything. Entrepreneurs have to be able to take a blow and just keep going. And not only take a blow, but it energizes them. As one of my students said a few weeks ago, it actually might even have been Jane. It said, what I learned from coming to class at MIT is you don't weather the storm. When there's a storm, you get out and dance in the raindrops. Because change is what entrepreneurs are about. Adversity should energize us. And I do not wish this on it, and the Silicon Valley thing wasn't. But the system actually worked. Silicon Valley was not a place of fraud. It actually was trying to do something different. And it could not be held back by a bank run. Nothing could be held back with. But they had high quality. I have no financial interest in any of this. But the quality of their assets is such that the people who are associated with that, the people who put their money in there, are going to get their money back, probably 100%. So I think there was a lot of agita through this. And that's unfortunate. It's disruptive to it. But you know what? That makes you stronger in some sense. And we always talk about entrepreneurship as being anti-fragile. You got to be able to take a blow and come back. And the system, I'm actually feeling quite good about right now. And then the government recognized that it's not that hard to fix this problem. And there was no fraud there and the like. So at the end of the day, I think it was something that was a distraction. It was very scary for a while there. But we're back. And let's get going and think about how do we avoid this in the future and build more anti-fragility into systems going forward? And we will be better for this, as we were talking about before we started this podcast. Finance matters in startups. It's not just about technology. It's about customer acquisition, but it's also you need to have finance. You need to have a well-balanced team. It's not just about writing some code and it goes viral. It's about having a well-balanced team that can give you strength in bringing products to market, strength in go-to-market strategy, but also strength in finance. So I think, by the way, Ken, that this has taken away from the bigger trend right now, which is this generative AI, which I think is very profound. And we're going to get back to that. That's one of the fundamental disruptions of our time. And I think that's where we're going to be back to in a few days.
Well, it sounds like a great subject for another podcast there. We have 48 portfolio companies, and I wish we had several founders between Thursday and actually just late last night sending emails out regularly. And I think this resilience comment you made earlier is well endowed in all of those. And so I wish I could publish those, but it was a fun weekend just reading the emails back and forth between these founders.
Yeah, that's what entrepreneurs need to do. They need to keep their cool. They need to say what's really matters here and let's keep pushing forward. And we will get hit.
Yeah.
I just want to say one other thing to your digital people out there, because this generative AI is huge. I remember, and I really made my name at IBM in the 1980s because I was a personal computer person. And I remember, you know, going in and there was resistance in corporations to these personal computers. Why? We have our, you know, we've got our spreadsheets, we've got our calculators, you know, our accounting system. And so we're automating your accounting systems, you know, and then they kind of bought into that. But then when the personal computer came along, we had this thing called a spreadsheet. It's called VisiCalc at the time. And I remember being there and seeing the resistance of people to VisiCalc. And I was like, wow. How can you resist VisiCalc? This is just a, and what happened was, is that I was the new guy on the block and I could see how powerful this was going to be. And yet there was resistance to do that and people would fight it. And now it's like crazy to think people would fight a spreadsheet, but they did. They did, Ken. I don't know if you remember this. They would say, well, we've got our calculators and we've been doing it this way. We write the numbers down. How do we know if it's correct? And how do I, if I look at a spreadsheet? We have the same thing going on now with generative AI. And I'll just give you a simple example is this ChatGPT, one of our very, very successful entrepreneurs, and I mean very successful, said, in our classroom, we're going to ban ChatGPT. And I had to sit down and say, this is crazy. let's just talk about this for a second. You're going to ban ChatGPT, yet, well, look, they could lose their job. Well, you're not going to stop ChatGPT. They're not going to lose their job to ChatGPT. They're going to lose their job to people who don't know how to use ChatGPT. And I'm not saying ChatGPT is the answer. I'm using it as a metaphor here. But that digital transformation that needs to happen, we all as leaders, entrepreneurs and organizations or wherever, we need to lead that by saying, how do we take this technology of ChatGPT and transform our organizations going forward rather than resist it? And we need to get out in front of that and understand there's going to be bumps in the road, just like there are with Silicon Valley coming up. And we need to bounce through those and figure out, yes, the longer term potential here is worth those bumps in the road. And we're going to get there. If I leave with nothing else here, I think we need to embrace this going forward. We need to be anti-fragile. I mean, I've said my theme in the past is kind of spirit of a pirate, execution skills of a Navy SEAL. The message I give going forward, and I think about all the time, is this anti-fragility, that the world is going to, it will never be slower than it is today. It's only going to get faster and faster. Think of ChatGPT got to 1 million users in 5 days, Ken. 5 days. 5 days, 1 million users. I mean, that is just mind-blowing. I remember when we sold PCs, how fast people thought PCs were adopted. We didn't get to 1 million PCs for 2 years. And then that was considered mind-blowing. And then just gets Spotify and these other things. And that's the trend. The world's going to go faster and faster. And for the leaders of industry, entrepreneurs inside large organizations, entrepreneurs in startups, in government, in academia, we need to embrace this change and not resist it. We need to see it as an opportunity and get stronger in the face of change. Anti-fragility is the concept that fragile systems break in the face of change. Resilience is the neutral condition where they kind of, you know, keep going, but they don't embrace the change. Anti-fragility says, hey, change is happening. This is our opportunity. Again, we're going to get out there and dance in the storm, not like sit inside and try to survive it. And that's the kind of leadership that we all need to have as chief digital officers, you know, transformation officers, innovation officers going forward. And if I leave with nothing point more than that, the world's going to go faster and faster. We need to embrace change as an opportunity, not resist it. And I love that story about the ChatGPT is just an example of that.
What a great conversation. If you had seen me behind the mic, I would have been saying yes with the high fives there. So.
That's it. I know, Ken, that's why I wanted to be here. I think this is what we need out there. We need to keep having that pipeline into corporations to transform it. And because small startups are great, but they're not scalable unless they get inside these bigger corporations to like take it to a whole nother level. And that's what you're doing. And I thank you for it.
Yeah, the catalytic effect. So. Well, look, Bill, on that note, let me thank you for sharing this time and these insights with us today.
Thank you, Ken, for having me, and good luck to all you out there, and go forth and be more anti-fragile.
Love it. So this has been Professor Bill Owlett, Managing Director, Martin Frust Center for MIT Entrepreneurship and Ethernet Investors Professor of the Practice, MIT Sloan School of Management. Thank you for listening, and please join us for the next episode of our Digital Thread podcast series. Thank you, and have a great day. You've been listening to the Momenta Digital Thread podcast series. We hope you've enjoyed the discussion, and as always, we welcome your comments and suggestions. Please check our website at momenta.one for archived versions of podcasts, as well as resources to help with your digital industry journey. Thank you for listening.